Welcome to the Negotiation in Real Life podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Davidson, and in this podcast, we'll explore the art and science of negotiation in real-world situations. Whether you're negotiating a business deal, asking for a raise, or trying to resolve a conflict with a colleague or loved one, negotiation is an essential skill that can help you achieve your goals and build better relationships. Through interviews with experts, real-life stories, and practical tips and techniques, we'll deep dive into the strategies and tactics that can make you a better negotiator. From understanding your own negotiation style, to reading body language, handling difficult conversations, and overcoming common challenges, this podcast will give you the tools you need to negotiate with confidence and achieve your objectives. So whether you're a seasoned negotiator looking to refine your skills, or someone who's new to the game, join us as we explore the world of negotiation in real life. Welcome back to Negotiation in Real Life. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Michael Tourkakis, who's a legal professional with a passion for advocating for his clients' best interests. With a background in law and a keen interest in negotiation and conflict resolution, Michael brings a wealth of experience to the table. He has a strong track record of successfully handling complex legal matters and is known for his strategic approach and attention to detail. In 2023, Michael was recognised for his excellence in the field, including being a finalist for Partner of the Year in Dispute Resolution for the Australian Lawyers Weekly Partner of the Year Awards and Litigator of the Year at the Lawyers Weekly Australian Law Awards. Sounds like 2023 was a great year for you, Michael. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Nicole. It was a real confidence booster 2023 for me, and it's just been great moving forward ever since.
Fantastic. And it is amazing, isn't it, where, you know, even though you're doing great work and, you know, doing what you love doing and doing it well, having that external recognition can be such a powerful thing, can't it?
It was. And not deviating away from the main sort of point of our podcast today, 2023 was obviously a year of highs and lows. Obviously, coming out of the lockdowns that Melbourne had, it really required me to consider where I stood as a solicitor, my passion for it, and to really hone into whether or not I was actually delivering those outcomes that I felt that I was achieving.
Yeah.
But the recognitions obviously added that sense of reassurance that I was doing obviously good work.
Fantastic. And look, I know you're a massive advocate for, although you're a litigation lawyer, you're a big fan of resolving things early where possible. You love the sort of the negotiation, and I like you actually call it dispute resolution. A lot of people talk about alternative dispute resolution. Correct. I think it's nice when it's talked about as the method. What drew you to have this interest in negotiation and conflict resolution rather than purely the litigation path?
Well, I think being an only child, I always felt that I was a peacemaker when it came to my parents and family. Coming from a Greek background, we have quite a few family members. They can be very passionate at times when they speak. And I remember from a young age, I used to obviously try to create a bit of a harmony amongst the family. But moving on, once I graduated with my bachelor's in law, I felt that I could do a bit more study. And it also came at a time where it was very difficult for a young lawyer without much experience to really get his foot in the door.
Mm.
So I decided to do my master's in law with Monash University. And the emphasis that I actually worked on was in dispute resolution.
Yep.
And it taught me the fundamental skills I needed to understand a bit more that the law isn't about just entering into a courtroom, but you could actually achieve a result by just simply discussing and putting forward your position and trying to find a middle ground. It gave me a bit of insight as well in other areas where you don't see as well, collaborative practice being one. When studying it, it was really focused in family law, and they were trying to really push it in that direction. And unless you can tell me otherwise, I have not really seen that continue on.
No, and I think that'll be something. I'd love to come back to that later in the podcast, because I am a big believer that some kind of
collaborative practice would make sense in commercial disputes as well. So might come back to that one. As you were doing that master's, what did that sort of make you think about the initial training that you had as a lawyer, which is obviously what every lawyer has? You've done this extra. What was missing for you from the original training that you realised as you went through the master's process?
My opinion would be the law degree gives you a very procedural sense of what the law is. Contract law is offer, acceptance, consideration, and intention to creating a legal binding contract. If those four elements don't exist, you're in court. Mm. It doesn't really offer you that sense of, well, what really occurred that made two parties start questioning whether or not there was really an issue here, and why don't we talk about it? So the master's just gave me that ability to understand there's a bit more than just focusing on the real elements of law and really coming into an understanding that the people that we will be helping are human.
Yep.
There is a lot of emotion that comes in with being part of a legal dispute. So you can treat them as a case study. You've got to treat them equally and to help them also achieve an outcome.
Mm.
As when they do come to us, it's always most likely due to a monetary dispute, whether it's a breach of a loan agreement, return of a deposit under a contract of sale. It could be a verbal agreement. Mm-hmm. It could also form part of contracts.
Yeah.
So they come to us. They've already either have spent money or they've lost money. So they want to try and obviously form a solution. They want an outcome. So you have to obviously consider the option of a negotiation or a dispute resolution process that exists, whether it is an arbitration or a mediation.
Mm-hmm.
And funny enough, if you look at documents that people draft, whether it is a partnership agreement, shareholders agreement, a contract of sale, even at times, any contract has a dispute resolution clause. Mm-hmm. But it seems that a lot of people tend to neglect that.
Yeah.
All they care about is I've got to go to court and I want to have my say and I'm going to get the outcome that I deserve and I'm just going to get all my costs, including my lawyer's costs, and it's on principle. The amount of times I hear the word, it's on principle. It's bizarre that people think that way.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I think there's a couple of things. One is, as you said, I mean, the majority of contracts these days will have a dispute resolution clause. And generally that's going to require the parties to negotiate first. If that fails, mediation is obviously the second step. But either parties haven't read their contracts and aren't aware of these clauses. And I think also they're coloured by the fact that what we see in, everyday TV and sort of common things that we're watching and learning about the law, if we're not lawyers, is you only ever see people go to court.
Mm-hmm.
So people sort of feel like that's where justice gets done. How do you go about convincing somebody that they need to think about some of these other alternatives?
I'm a very honest person and I show my honesty to all the clients that I represent. And at the very beginning, I give them a real breakdown as to how litigation will occur, including how it may end. And what a lot of people do not see or understand is that if you succeed and get a good result, the court isn't going to compel the other party to pay the order or actually perform it.
Mm.
In addition to that, there is cost agreements and disclosure statements that we as solicitors are obligated to give to clients. We make it clear that they could receive anywhere between 65 to 75% of the legal costs. But to achieve that, the file has to get costed.
Mm.
So the matter will be adjourned. The file will go to a cost expert. An invoice will be rendered. It will then be incorporated into the order. And then the next step will occur, which will be either polite correspondence of please pay or the alternative debt enforcement.
Yeah.
In addition to that, I also explain to people that any client of a lawyer will come in trusting you to help them.
Mm.
So when you find yourself in a position where you have been the losing party, that trust is broken.
Yeah.
Which means with a deteriorated relationship, that person can disappear. So how can you then recover legal costs and the actual court order when they've already vanished?
Yeah.
And you won't be able to track them down. So mediating, negotiating, and coming to an agreement that you can live with,
yeah,
to me seems to be the best course of action that I can offer someone, rather than putting them in that courtroom and not knowing whether or not, if I succeed and they love me and appreciate it or appreciate me for it, I'll be able to then get that recovery for them.
Yeah, and I love that phrase that you used, you know, mediation. It's looking for what is that outcome they can live with.
Correct.
Because it's always going to be less than what they would hope for, and probably less than what the number might be if it went to court and they were successful. But you're taking out the risk of that. How do you help people, you know, when you've got that situation, perhaps you're in a negotiation or even a mediation and there's those offers on the table? How are you advising somebody whether they should take that offer or go on and pursue the legal proceedings?
So what I do is provide a cost-benefit analysis, either at a mediation or through the correspondence, the Calder Bank offers or the offers of compromise that are provided in accordance with the rules. You sit down and you discuss what the offer is, how much money has already been spent, and how much will be spent moving forward. The additional reality is also that people want to know how much things will cost.
Yeah.
And those things will be legal costs.
Yeah.
So they'll always say, tell me how much it's going to cost to get to X. And all you can do is provide an estimate, but you can't predict your opponent's actions or the alternatives that can also come about that can also inflate that.
I was going to say, I mean, this is the challenge, isn't it? Because it's the behavior of the other side will determine whether this is something that's at the lower end of the cost scale for your client or the upper, because the lawyer who has a really commercial approach on the other side and is trying to minimize for their costs for their client will also, by their behavior, minimize costs for your client. Mm-hmm. But if you've got someone who's a particularly aggressive litigator on the other side who's following every procedural loophole and, you know, I'm not going to hand over a document unless you make a subpoena, and they make it as difficult for you as possible, it also makes it expensive for your client. So I guess as you work with particular lawyers, you get a feel for whether this is likely to be at the lower or the more expensive end.
Very true. And you're right. And as we explained earlier, it's that unpredictability of it all. So when we look at an offer, it's just a matter of looking at the emotional toll the person has obviously gone through. The offer could be in its early stages of a litigation. It could also be in a 2 or 3 year litigation process where enough is enough for that particular person. They've invested too much time in this case that their business is also affected as well. So I look at the totality of it.
Yeah.
And it's not a matter of, so it's not just me talking about what the offer is in front of them, but also looking at everything that also can cause a complexity to them continuing on with this trial, or even also focusing on the ability to recover as well.
Yeah.
One example that I had was a settlement that I achieved last year,
mm-hmm.
where we were dealing with a $1.5 million debt. It was to do with a breach of a lease, and the matter had gone on during COVID. We were out of COVID. The defendant had gone through two sets of lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
There was non-compliance by them. We were doing all the work, and that's another problem too. When there's non-compliance by your opponent, in order to progress a litigation, you have to spend more money to get it to continue. We had two mediations. The first mediation, they did not want to put any offers on the table. Mm-hmm. Second mediation, they received better advice, but they were still very difficult to deal with. So 2 weeks before trial, they put forward an offer, which was, it was reasonable, but we knew we could have gotten more.
Yep.
And when I was told to think about whether, if I was in their shoes, I would take it, I explained to them the history of the matter that we had, the difficulty of the defendant, the fact that they had gone through numerous lawyers, and what stopped him from, again, leaving those lawyers and then obviously having to go through a barrel of insolvency or another debt recovery process and the cost in that.
Yeah.
And doing and being an insolvency lawyer as well, I know that when it comes to bankruptcies or winding ups, you give it to the hands of the trustee and to the liquidator, who will then do the work needed to recover that debt. But they will obviously be very methodical, diligent. It could take 6 to 12 months, if not longer, just to recover some money to pay these people as well.
Absolutely. And of course, with that insolvency situation, it's the trustee or the liquidator, they'll get their fees. You, the petition, if your client is the one that's petitioned for the liquidation or the bankruptcy, they might get the costs of those applications back in priority, but then they'll only get a proportion of what they are actually owed as the debt alongside all the other creditors. They don't actually get any major benefit from being the one that's gone to the expense and trouble of bankrupting or liquidating somebody.
And there's no guarantee.
Yeah.
There is secured creditors, there's unsecured creditors. You never know whether you'll be able to recover your full amount. Mm. Someone else will jump on and say that they get priority. It's just a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah.
So in the end, I just explained all those uncertainties that can exist, which they were happy with. And they swallowed their pride and they walked away. They got their legal fees paid, which was great.
Yep.
They received at least, I would call it profit, probably not the word I would like to use, but they received some cash flow that at least made them feel comfortable that they achieved an outcome.
An outcome, yeah. And that's it sometimes, isn't it? It's the person needs to feel that they've got something. If all they got was just their legal fees and they were back in the position that they would be, they're going to be unhappy.
Correct.
So they've got to feel something. And equally, what I've found in some mediations is I remember I had one where we were all about, you know, they'd agreed sort of on the amount that was going to get paid, but the, let's call them the plaintiff, said, well, I want that to be my legal fees plus X. And the other party said, no way am I paying your legal fees. So I said, okay, well, you believe that it's this much for the settlement. You know, you treat the whole thing as if it's going to be settlement sum and you're not paying legal fees. They can call it what they like because they'd actually got into such an argument about whether the defendant was paying the legal fees or not. I'm like, you're just paying X amount of dollars. And they went, okay. You know, and it's little things because I laugh at some of these things going, but it's so simple.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when people are caught up in that heat of the moment, isn't it?
It's so true. And I'm involved in deceased estate matters as well, Part 4 claims or test inventory capacity claims.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the offers on the table, you can either make a total amount offer or it's the offer in the estate plus the legal costs.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the plus legal costs, it's exactly what you say, Nicole. It's the question of why should I be paying this? And I'm in this as much as the other parties in
it.
So you try to obviously try and consolidate it.
Yeah.
you hear a lot more offers being a total lump sum rather than I want this, plus I also want my legal costs. Yeah.
I'm interested too, and I think I know what I would do in these situations, but of course you've talked about some defendants who can, you know, have a tendency perhaps to be a bit slippery. So you can come to a negotiated outcome with them and say, okay, well, yes, I'll compromise on my debt. We'll put an agreement in place about what you're going to pay me. How do you protect your client to make sure that the defendant actually does pay the amount that they've agreed to pay?
In a litigation sense, the only protection that can really exist would be the assurance that there is carefully drafted terms in a deed of settlement that can warrant the ability to reinstate a matter and get judgment for the amount that has been agreed. Again, that can have risk. But I believe that's probably the only way that you could really achieve that.
And that's typically what I will see. It's that default judgment clause that says if you don't make the payments that you've promised by the due date, then you give us permission to issue in the court or to reissue and you won't defend the claim so that we can get a court order and then we can go down the the process to actually get those orders implemented.
Correct. You can...
Saves you having the cost of a trial.
Exactly right. You can have also terms that can allow you to lodge caveats maybe on properties if you're dealing with a individual. You could go beyond that and see whether they could agree to allowing you to enter into a second mortgage.
Yep.
But obviously that would require deeds of priority perhaps and adds another bucket worth of complexity there.
Yeah.
But every single element that I can analyze, that would be how do I convince someone to pay, always comes with, to me, being an overthinker, risk.
This is it, isn't it? I mean, the best way to make sure that they pay is to get the money now. So every delay, everything else. But I guess it's making sure, and I always say, you know, before you actually pop the champagne and go, yay, we've settled, you need to be making sure that you're comfortable, that you've considered those risks and put in place something that, because the other thing is all of these things can cost money. Mm-hmm. So you want to have done a sensible sort of cost-benefit analysis. For example, is it worth putting a caveat on? Is it worth taking out some sort of security interest or something, because obviously it's expensive to do some of those things.
Exactly right. And if you're dealing with a company and the client or the individual believes that there's no real asset in the company, can you entertain or convince the other side, your opponent or even me, to enable a guarantee to be added into it so you can chase them if the company doesn't pay? So by chasing them, I mean the guarantor. Director at the time. Again, there is options.
Yep.
And hopefully you don't need to deal with the enforcement side of it. I am lucky to say that I have not ever looked at using a debt enforcement from a deed of settlement.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that the negotiations and the outcomes that we have achieved, either as plaintiffs and defendants, so worked on both sides of the spectrum, have been in decisions that people have conceded and they have actually undertaken.
Yeah.
So
that's a pretty good record, I think.
I'm glad that that has happened. I would find that I would be putting people in a disadvantage if I believed that if I was representing a party where I had to give money that I was misleading them, or alternatively where I would be putting forward a proposal to resolve this, that it is in the sense that everyone's in agreement to it and we're not adding any sense of duress.
Yes, absolutely. Really important.
And obviously with your accolades in mediation and being a mediator, I guess you can see when someone feels pressured to actually agree to something, and you probably would look at pausing that and
totally
tell someone, look, you don't have to.
It's much better to give someone time to reflect and decide than to have everyone walk away thinking they've got an agreement and then actually escalating the conflict because that agreement falls over.
Exactly. And that's to do with obviously controlling the outcome that we have as yourself as a mediator and myself as being involved in dispute resolution and having that flexibility as well. It's also confidential too.
Yeah, and that's it.
The other issue is the comments that I sometimes make about, do you want to obviously have a court decision over your head? And if you type in on Auslee with a certain case, the decision is right there in front of you. And you don't want to obviously have that.
It's not necessarily the thing people want to go down in history for, is it?
No.
No. So my next question for you, Michael, is when's the right time to mediate?
That's a very interesting question because I have undertaken pre-litigation mediation.
Yep.
I have also undertaken court-appointed mediations. I must confess, and I'm not disrespecting the pre-litigation mediation approach. It's a choice that we make. But I find that when we enter into those steps, it appears to be more of a fishing expedition where if no pleadings are done, you sit there with a mediator that obviously has gotten the brief. You have provided some critical documents to obviously facilitate the discussion. So already discovery's been provided, but they like to hear how you're going to articulate your pleadings. And in return, the defendants can sometimes not really be in good faith willing to negotiate and just put forward an offer which is unrealistic, just to leave and say, all right, now we know obviously that if this goes any further, it's probably not going to be worth fighting, or we can strongly defend this. But then there's also pre-litigation mediation about being there, and we have resolved it on a very well-versed terms of settlement because no one wants to spend the cost of litigation. And it's in circumstances where people understand that there's skeletons in their closet, most likely, but they don't want to obviously show moving forward. And it's been beneficial as well.
Yeah. And I think that's it, isn't it? Because if you've got a willing defendant, and, you know, no one wants to be a defendant, but if they actually recognise that there is a problem and they're willing to come to the table and resolve it, then the earlier that you negotiate or mediate, the better, because both sides are going to save costs. But if you've got a defendant who goes, yeah, I know I'm screwed, I'm going to draw this out as long as possible to actually avoid having to pay for as long as possible and do all of that, then there may be less sort of value in doing that earlier mediation. Although I do think, even, you know, you said, oh, they use it as a fishing expedition and then they have an idea of how you're going to put the case. I think that's going to have a big impact on how they defend the case and what offers that they might make. So I would say that there's still value in that fishing expedition through the mediation process, but I'm a little biased on that too.
Well, I also agree with that too, because I know that we have an overarching obligation under the rules to minimise the issues and disputes.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, it's sort of how you perceive, obviously, the approach of the other side. Mm. But just to give you another example, quite recently, we're representing a client in relation to another breach of contract dispute, and we wrote to their solicitors to, by way of a call to Bangkok, but it was more so a position that we felt was pretty strong in our favor, and we wanted obviously some restitution out of that. The lawyers for the defendant wrote back and they said, right, in order to consider all this, we want X, Y, and Z, but we also want to do a roundtable conference.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I had no objection for that, but I replied back to actually say, why not a mediation? You clearly have your opinions and I have mine. And someone who is in a third party could control us from flaring up as to our passionate issues that we have in front of us that can at least achieve probably a result on that day. So why not consider a mediation rather than a roundtable conference? They went silent.
Fascinating.
And it just made me think, What were you trying to achieve?
Mm.
And unfortunately, now we're looking at moving forward to commencing proceedings, which wasn't what I wanted to do in the first place. And it felt like we had someone that could have been willing to compromise. But I was just curious about that. And I tried to entertain a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not leave the emails unanswered. I know sometimes there is a few people that like to type emails, but don't want to pick up the phone.
Yeah.
And I must confess, sometimes I'm that too. But I was very curious about why things went so quiet. They wanted some documents. And I was happy to provide it if we could at least see whether we could get a mediation. And the phone calls that I took, that I tried, we weren't able to reach him or her. And we haven't heard from him since. Now, it could be that their client has probably not provided any instructions or they may no longer be representing them. It'll be good if we knew that so we could write to them.
Yes.
But it's a bit heartbreaking that there was this option that could have closed the book on this.
Yeah.
At a fraction of the cost. But now it's heading down a path which will result in a mediation anyway.
Absolutely. And this is where, you know, I think we've had this discussion before, Michael. I'm a big advocate that it should be a requirement to mediate before you go down the path of actually issuing, unless there's a really valid reason not to. Because I think, you know, there is that real benefit. But I shan't turn this into a major spruiking session for mediation services. I am conscious of the time, though, and being respectful to our listeners. If you were to give either business people or perhaps fresh law grads one piece of advice about dispute resolution, what would be your golden nugget?
Well, I would say hone into it and look towards resolving things commercially, amicably, minimizing everyone's costs, keeping it flexible, keeping it confidential, considering the time efficiency for everyone. You know, being a business owner, I'm sure you would rather focus on your business rather than dealing with lawyers such as myself. Being a law graduate, try and obviously resolve that file so you can move on to the next.
Mm.
You know, the biggest problem that you can sometimes create is an influx of volume of files that see no end, and you're just adding on top of that.
Yeah.
So coming to some sort of compromise, I feel, just helps everyone.
Yeah. Excellent advice, I think. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Nicole, thank you for having me. And again, it's been a pleasure.
All good.
That's all for this episode of the Negotiation in Real Life podcast. I hope you enjoyed our discussion and learned something new that you can apply in your own negotiations. Remember, negotiation is a skill that can be developed and refined over time, so keep practicing and pushing yourself out of your comfort zone. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, please don't hesitate to reach out. You can find us on social media or email us directly. And if you liked this episode, please leave us a review on your favourite podcast platform. It helps us to reach more people and continue to produce high-quality content. Until next time, keep negotiating in real life.